supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later on the show, we will discuss potash, an ancient term used to define the K in NPK. We'll tell you what it does for your plants, how to get it into your garden, and we'll touch on why the state of California doesn't think too much of it. In the meantime, though, lots of your fabulous phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Bob, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, Mike. Thanks for taking my call.
Thank you for making it, Bob. Where are you, sir?
I'm calling from Langhorne, Pennsylvania.
Gotcha. I know exactly where you are. What can we do for Bob just north of Philadelphia?
Yeah. So, Mike, I live on a corner property. Behind our house, we have a big row of giant arborvitaes, and on the other side, we have a big string of pine trees. But I also have a really busy corner, and I've been looking to do something out there for some privacy so I don't have to see so much traffic. Because I have so many pines, I was actually thinking of putting up some large evergreen shrubs. And because of the slope of the property, I have two questions for you. I may have to put a little berm under these bushes. And I wanted to know, is there anything I should be doing to prep for that? I really want to make this, you know, go in the spring and really make it come out good.
Well, wait a minute. Yeah. Now, by berm, you mean like a speed bump?
Yeah, like a speed bump. I was thinking I want to create a barrier of about 8 foot tall, and I don't know if I'm going to be able to get some evergreen shrubs at that height yet.
Okay, so you're essentially talking about putting plants that really like to be planted in flat earth and putting them into some kind of a raised bed. Are you doing this for height, or you said you're worried about a slope? What's the real reason here?
Well, both things. I'd like to have a barrier of about, I think I'm going to need about 8 feet tall. Our yard slopes, so in order to cover it high enough to prevent us seeing all the traffic, I need to get some height there.
So it slopes down towards the street?
Yes, sir. Yep.
Okay. I don't like it. I have friends who decided without asking me that plants on a berm would be easier to take care of. Somehow they wouldn't need weeding or anything. And what we learned in physical reality was the berm dries out fast.
Oh, okay.
All the water drains out of that. And these plants, which are about on a berm about 2 feet high, it was impossible to keep them watered in the summer. That elevated area would dry out first, and also because it was elevated, it was actually hard to get the water into it.
Okay. This is a full sun area too, so.
Yeah, and you're also now destabilizing the root system.
Okay.
Instead of the roots being down in what I presume is really crappy soil in Langhorne,
right? Yeah, it's a lot of clay.
Yeah, exactly. Instead of the roots being in that, which is like anchoring them, you're making the rookie mistake of planting them in some sort of nice soil where people could literally just rock them out of the ground.
Okay.
Much less them falling over by themselves. So I would say that no matter what, let's forget the berm.
Okay.
One thing I recommend in these kind of screening situations is ornamental grasses. They grow fast. They spread wide, especially the ones with the plumes. Now, you have to make sure you get ones with plumes that are not invasive plants, but you can find them. But once those plumes appear, they put on a beautiful show, and they can easily be 10 feet tall.
Yeah, I love those. Now, I thought I heard on a show of yours, I didn't want to get into cutting them down every year, and I thought you had someone from a local arboretum who said that you don't necessarily have to cut them back.
That's correct.
I don't know how they look if you don't cut them back.
That's correct. They look rustic. I don't know. Not distressed. No. What happens is they will grow an amazing volume of green material in a year. Over the winter, it'll go dormant. It'll turn a little tan and brown. In the spring, new growth will spring up from the center. And in the center of the brown material, this green lantern coming up out of the center is just an amazing look. And once that new greenery gets to a certain height, a lot of times people do take off some of the old leaves, but you don't have to.
Okay.
And that
okay.
means you've got a much wider bush that covers an area from side to side.
Okay.
And if you ever decide you want to cut them, you know, that brown material is as good as fall leaves for shredding and and compost making. They grow fast. They're very attractive. They're great screening plants. Just don't plant them in a straight row. Stagger them like you're racking up pool balls.
Okay.
I just happen to think that, you know, with a situation like this, you get the most bang for your buck from ornamental grasses and you get
grasses.
The coverage
okay.
in 1 year.
All right. Great. That gave me a lot to think about. Thank you very much.
All right. Good luck, Bob.
Thank you. Take care.
You too.
Bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Sam, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hey, hello, Mike. How are you doing?
I am doing just fine today. Sam, how are you, sir?
I'm doing good also.
And where is Sam doing good?
We're just north of Joplin, Missouri. That's in the southwest corner of the state.
Okay, very good. What can we do for Sam in Missouri?
Well, I was worried about what you'd been saying about amending tree hoes when you plant new trees.
Right.
We live in a location where it's not very good soil. We moved here in 2005, and I planted several trees, and we were getting ready to plant around the drip line of a weeping peach tree. Anyway, I wanted to plant tulips and daffodils and crocus and stuff like that, so I went real carefully around the edge and because I wanted to plant down pretty deep, you know, about 8 inches deep. And as I worked, I had to use small hand tools because the roots were just really growing well, clear out around the drip line. So it made me feel a little better about the fact that I had amended my hose. And where we live is pretty much in the old mining for lead and zinc. It was a big thing back in the mining days, boom time, late 1800s, early 1900s. And we had a lot of what they call chat. It's a waste from when they do the mining to get the ore for the lead and zinc.
Are you saying you're living amongst lead and cadmium waste and stuff like that?
Well, yeah, there could be. The EPA has been cleaning up the sites around here where there used to be mountains of this waste. They've cleared it all out and reclaimed the ground.
Have you had your soil tested? It seems like if you live that close to where the mines were, the government should be testing your soil for free. The heck with your trees. I'm glad the roots grew out well, but I'm worried about you, man.
Yeah. Well, I seem to be doing fine. No, I haven't had the soil tested.
I would definitely have a sample tested for lead and heavy metals, no matter what else. You got to garden with gloves, and you should probably be wearing a dust mask as well. When people think about lead-contaminated soil, they worry, oh, will the peaches or the string beans poison me? And that's not the danger. The danger is actually you releasing the lead dust in the soil and inhaling it or getting it through your skin. So it's very important when you work in areas like this to protect yourself, to always wear gloves, always wear, you know, just a basic dust mask and to wash up well when you go inside. So you're saying because your soil was so lousy, you did when you planted your trees, you put peat moss and compost and everything else in the planting hole?
Yeah, and of course, the first thing I did was remove all the rocks and you know, the junk and debris, and then I like to screen all of my soil before I put it back in, and then I mix in some topsoil and compost and maybe a little peat moss once in a while.
Right, so, and it sounds like maybe you dug really wide holes and improved the soil going pretty far out.
Oh, yeah. Pretty big hoe, yeah.
You know, there are exceptions to every rule. I think a lot of times what we're talking about here on the show is when people have clay soil that is really impenetrable, and they make a nice little tiny island of good soil of compost or peat moss down in the hole. The roots have no interest in leaving that area. But if you have basically loose soil outside of it, it's okay to do that. But there's absolutely no reason to do it. But, you know, as we go forward, I would urge you to take precautions, just to wear a simple mask, to wear gloves. And I have to tell you, I also don't like the idea of planting among the tree roots of the spring bulbs coming up. you're really mm-hmm. not going to see that in nature. And you even kind of implied that you were banging into the roots quite a bit.
Yeah, well, I had to be careful digging. I had to use small digging tools, of course.
I would not risk the health of that tree to put a couple of spring bulbs in the ground around that. I'd find another place for the bulbs.
They're already planted. Of course, I'm expecting when this tree is in full bloom, I'm hoping that I've got spring bulbs to go along with them. So
it could look nice. It could look nice.
Yeah,
and if
you
know, if you really took your time, it could work out well. But you be careful.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
I always take my time. And I do wear gloves when I'm digging because I've found sharp stuff and mm-hmm. everything else. But, yeah.
Okay.
Most of the time, the soil has been really moist, so I'm not too concerned about the dust, but since you brought it up, maybe I should wear a dust mask.
Yeah, yeah. It would make me sleep better at night.
Okay, if it'll make you sleep better, Mike, yeah. I'll have some dust mask I use once in a while. So.
All right, well, good luck, sir.
Okay, thank you.
Take care.
Bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and finalize our plans for the upcoming Philadelphia Flower Show. I'll be doing my annual organic Q&A at the Gardener's Studio on the show floor at 4 p.m. on Wednesday, March 7th. And if you're interested in being part of a very special experience with me at the Flower Show, listen to the live stream of our show on Saturday, February 3rd at noon on Philadelphia's WHYY-FM for a very special opportunity available that hour only. I'm Mike McGrath, and I can say no more other than you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And High Caliper Growing, creators of the original Smart Pot, Big Bag Bed, and other fabric growing containers made in the USA. Remember, the container you use affects the plants you grow. SmartPots.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, it is the K in the famous NPK you see on the label of every fertilizer, liquid, or solid out there. A lot of old-time gardeners call it potash. We'll tell you why, and we'll tell you all about it after lots of your fabulous phone calls. At 1-888-346-9499. Paul, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. How are you today?
I am just ducky, Paul. How you doing, man?
I'm doing pretty good. Trying to stay warm, but not too bad.
And where is Paul doing pretty good?
I'm calling from Lincoln University, Pennsylvania. It's about 20 minutes south of Kennett Square.
All right. What can we do for Paul near Kennett Square?
I have three citrus trees. Two of them I inherited from my in-laws about 10 years ago. The trees themselves are over 40 years old, so they're very well established. I keep them outside during the warmer months, and I bring them inside for the winter. Keep them in my kind of sunroom near a heat vent to try to give them some extra heat. And just last year, they just started bearing fruit.
After 40 years?
Yeah, believe it or not.
You're a very patient man, Paul.
Yeah. Now, I don't know that my in-laws ever fertilized them, and I'm guessing that the reason that they have fruit this year is because of a fertilizer regimen that I was doing last year. I would feed them every other week. So they were doing really well, and they seem to be doing fine now indoors. The one tree, which I think is a kumquat tree, and the other tree I believe is a grapefruit tree. Again, not positive on that as well. The fruit is actually the same on both trees. But the only difference between the two is one has thorns and the other does not. So I'm kind of puzzled there as to what they actually are.
And obviously the one thing you'll rule out is they don't look like lemons, the fruit.
Correct.
Right.
They are orange. And they're about 1 inch in diameter. So they're not very big.
And you say they're very thorny?
The taller tree is thorny. The bark has thorns on it that are about 3/4 of an inch long, so they're pretty nasty.
Okay. Years ago, a listener turned me on to a plant that I didn't know existed at the time called the hardy orange, and this is a true citrus that grows outdoors here in the mid-Atlantic states, survives all winter long, produces small orange-like fruits of the type you're describing, and has lots of thorns on it. But it's called bitter orange because it's bitter. And when
right.
you cut it open, it's very distinctive. I mean, nature has jammed more seeds into each of those fruits than you can possibly imagine. It has a very distinct,
sure.
It almost looks like a pomegranate when you open it up.
They do tend to be bitter, so we really haven't done much with them.
So you fertilize them. I presume you used a chemical fertilizer.
Yeah, it's an all-purpose plant food. It's 15-30-15.
Okay, so in one way, you did the right thing. Indoor citrus, outdoor citrus, they are very hungry plants, and they do need to be fed to produce. But one of the dangers, you know, in addition to the fact that we just don't support chemical fertilizers here, is when you've got these plants in pots, those chemical salts can build up very quickly. I would encourage you to switch over to a more natural food, but to keep feeding, not every 2 weeks, though. Nothing needs to be fed every 2 weeks. You know, maybe every month or so when it's actively growing. But you don't want to overdo anything, even a good thing. Now, is your little sunroom, is it chilly in there?
No, it's probably about 65 degrees.
Okay. I would keep the plants away from the heat vent. Having plants near a forced air, hot air thing tends to cause leaf drop, tends to make that plant dry out on that side a little too quickly. What kind of pots are they in? Are they plastic? Are they terracotta?
They're plastic.
Okay. So that gives you a little bit of wiggle room, but still, they don't want to be either in a draft or in warm air. They do want to get as much sunlight as you can. They do want to get a lot of water. So they did flower for you. Were the flowers fragrant?
Yes.
So the house smelled great while they were flowering. And typically with a citrus that comes indoors, grafted citrus, this is the time of year where you'll be getting ripe fruits. And that's where we are now. You have fully colored up fruits?
Correct.
And they started out greenish and they've progressed to a different color?
Right. Yep.
Well, what you got is what you got. It's not going to get much better than this. I think the thorny one may be hardy orange. If you want to be sure, you can just take it outside and leave it out next winter. And if it doesn't die, that's what you got. But it's an interesting curiosity. It brings color into your house in the winter time, and the smell of the blossom should be fragrant, right?
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Now I have a variegated lemon tree. That's only about 2 years old, and that's not doing well. That's only got maybe 10 leaves on it.
Basically, the secrets of taking good care of a Meyer lemon plant or an indoor lemon are they do need to be fed. They like a lot of bright light. They like a lot of sun. They like a moist soil. And they do like to be out in the summertime, but they do not like to be exposed to any level of cold. So they go out late and they come in early. Forget freezing. These plants have no sense of humor about temps in the low 40s. And what you're describing there also sounds like a plant too close to a heat vent. And that's just death on a stick for most of these things. So if you want to start over, you would be feeding it regularly with organic food, giving it lots of bright light, making sure it's not out during any cold spells, keeping it well watered, and then things should work out much better.
Okay. All right, great. I'll try all those things.
All right, good luck, sir.
Well, thank you, Mike. I appreciate your show.
Take care. Thank you.
You too. Bye.
1-888-346-9499. Jesse, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi. I'd like to talk about the couple of palm trees that I planted.
And where has Jesse planted these palm trees?
It's in Lower Township, New Jersey, in Cape May County.
Oh, okay. So how close are you to the ocean?
About 1 to 2 miles, 1 mile from the bay, and like 3 or 4 miles from the ocean itself.
Okay. So you're growing real palm trees?
Correct.
All right. Tell us.
The first one that I started growing was the Brucia capitata, which is commonly known as the jelly palm.
The jelly palm. That's such a great common name.
And the reason why they call it that is because they use the fruit itself to make fruit spreads or jelly.
Okay, so this is a truly tropical plant, but it's interesting because it's rated from zone 8 and above, and you say you're zone 7B, so you're kind of almost kissing an 8 with the ocean there near
that's
you.
That's true.
You say there are others. Let's talk about the jelly palm. How long have you had
that since July, I believe, or June.
Okay, so you planted it over the summer.
Yes, all of them were planted during the summer season.
And what did you plant exactly? How big were the small trees, or what did you do?
Okay, the first one that I planted was only about between 1 to 2 feet tall. And the other one that I ordered from Fast Growing Trees, which is the next tree I'll talk about, is the same exact height, 1 to 2 feet tall. And then I got another one that's the same tree as that one, which is the Chinese windmill palm. I bought that from Lowe's, and that is actually 3 to 4 feet tall.
And you planted them both over the summer. Now, these are kind of well-known plants, and the other one is Chinese windmill palm?
That's the common name. And the first one is actually the jelly palm. It's the most hardiest feathery palm that there is.
Well, I'm cheating as we're talking. I'm taking a look through my hortus here. You know, these are interesting palm trees because technically they're semi-tropical. But it says on both descriptions that they're really prized because in certain conditions they can be fairly frost hardy.
They like the cold winters. These actually don't grow in the tropical areas. They like subtropical or warm temperate.
Okay. How big do you expect them to get, Jess?
I'm hoping maybe 30 to 40 feet.
Oh, that'll be quite a display. Is there anything like this around you?
Harpoon Henry's, which is on Town Bank Road, has Chinese windmill palms. And then also there's a house on Seashore Road next to the Church of the Nazarene that grew pindo palm trees.
Okay.
That's how I got the idea of those two, but most from the research.
And are you doing anything to protect them over the winter?
Sure, yes. I mulched them during the summer, and I put stones around on the ornamental ones, which were from Japan and China.
Right.
And then the pindo, I put bricks around it, and what I did when I put the mulch from in there, I applied like 3 inches, the maximum amount of mulch you can apply, which was the black mulch, because it heats up better and keeps the roots warm.
Okay.
And then I cut pieces of bamboo from the woods with a hacksaw, and I just hammered them down with a piece of wood and then placed them inside the holes. And then not until December, before it started, first time it started snowing,
right,
when I checked the weather, I started wrapping them up with burlap. And then I put clothesline around it, and I use clothespins to hold it all together. And then I put Christmas lights around it.
Now, is the Christmas lights just because you had structure out there, or you're using that to keep the plants a little bit warmer?
The most reason why is to harness the burlap together.
Have you peaked?
Yeah, I peaked during December and this month, and they look green. Especially
okay.
Especially the pindo palm, the jelly palm.
So I'm guessing your big task here is to get them to a decent size
And I don't have to wrap them anymore.
Right. Every year after that, you'll do less and less to protect them over the winter.
It says to keep them wrapped until they're mature, according to what I read. And I started noticing that the Chinese windmill palm was trying to poke its way out of the burlap during the winter.
That's a good sign.
It somehow responds to cold temperatures, grows best during the cold and the heat.
Well, the brief descriptions I'm reading while we're talking describe these as being really unusual, and they really are prized for their cold hardiness, especially in Europe, where people love...
Yeah, they grow all the way up to northern Pennsylvania.
Yeah, well, people love growing these things.
But, zone 5.
But they belong down the shore. You got them in the right place.
Yeah, it says they like sandy soil, both those types of palm trees that I mentioned.
Well,
so
you
got
might...
the right type of soil and the right climate for it.
You know, maybe if you can turn people on to this, we can get more real palm trees down in Wildwood.
That's what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to bring Florida or Georgia to New Jersey instead of people trying to travel all the time.
Well, we wish you great success.
Thank you. I appreciate it as well for this phone call.
All right. You take care, Jess.
You too. Bye.
1-888-346-9499. Tracy, welcome to You Bet Your Garden. Hi, Tracy.
How are you?
I'm doing good, Trace. How are you?
I'm freezing my bonesies off right now.
Well, you could be anywhere in the country this winter. It has been brutal. Where are you, Trace?
I'm in East Tennessee, Sneebel.
East Tennessee.
I can almost see Kentucky and Virginia from where I am.
Okay, so you're one of our listeners in the Tri-Cities area.
Right.
All right, what can we do for Tracy in Tennessee near the Tri-Cities?
I had a question about my compost. My husband and I have been going round and round. Every time he cleans out the chimney flue, he takes the creosote out and puts it in my compost heap.
What?
And my instincts tell me that that's not a good thing, but he just keeps forgetting and doing it. I just wondered, is it a bad thing?
He keeps forgetting and doing it?
Well, he just forgets that I told him I don't think he ought to do that.
Okay, so is there a hardware store nearby that can make signs for you?
Yes.
You want the sign to say, honey, back off, big letters, maybe in red, and then underneath, see if they can have an image of a 12-gauge shotgun. There's nothing gets a man's attention who knows he's doing something wrong like the image of a shotgun.
Yeah, I see your point.
Now,
so my instincts are right. That's not a good thing.
Oh, my goodness. No, it is possibly the worst thing I've ever heard. Actually, no. Dog and cat feces added to compost can create a terrible immediate health hazard because they can put parasites into the soil that you would then pick up when you work the soil with your hands. That's probably worse. Common mistakes people make are using fireplace ash in their compost pile because it's very alkaline and it upsets the balance.
I do put that in there from my wood stove. I put the wood ashes from my wood stove in there, so I should stop that.
You should stop doing that. Now, you may have noticed that putting the wood ash in a compost pile tends to stop the composting process dead.
I didn't connect the two.
One way to remember what to put into a compost pile and what not is we use the term raw ingredients. So leaves are basically unchanged. We shred them to get them to break up better, but they're basically unchanged. The food we don't eat in the kitchen that gets mixed in there, that's raw. Grass clippings from an untreated lawn, a lawn that hasn't been treated with herbicide, they're raw. But if you think about wood ash, it's already been changed in form. It's already been utilized. Wood is raw, but it takes forever to break down. But wood ashes are actually alkaline. And if you think about out west where the soils are alkaline, nothing grows there. So
okay, well, I'll remember that.
Yeah, they are good for, quote, liming a lawn. That's a great use for them. Unfortunately, the creosote that your husband is getting off the inside of your chimney, it is one of the few substances that scientists agree is a definite carcinogen. It's a definite cause of cancer in humans, which is why creosote is not used in wood preservation anymore.
I see. Okay.
So when he's cleaning the flue, when he's playing chimney sweep, he should be wearing protective gear. He should at least have a dust mask on. And that stuff should be double bagged and gotten rid of legally. That's a very dangerous, toxic substance that has no use in the home or garden.
Okay.
The best thing for compost is a lot of shredded leaves, some coffee grounds, and a little bit of kitchen waste, and you'll go to town.
Okay. And when I clean the chicken house out, I usually put that in there.
That's great. That's absolutely great. Just make sure it's not too much. As like 20% of a compost pile, it's perfect. And chicken litter and shredded leaves together would make the absolute perfect compost.
Okay.
But we want you to make that sign up.
I will. I'll hustle right over to the hardware store and have them get to work on that.
Honey, back off 12-gauge.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot. I appreciate it.
All right, Tracy. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce a change in one of my upcoming appearances. I will return to the Brandywine 100 Library, not on the date previously mentioned, because that's when I'm also at the Philadelphia Flower Show, and my astral projection projector is down. 31 days in March, and I booked 2 shows on one of them. Nice work. Anyway, I will instead return to the Brandywine 100 Library on Thursday evening, February 27th. But don't go marking up your calendar just yet, because we'll be right back with Ashes from Pots and your ash and phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com. And High Caliper Growing, creators of the original Smart Pot, Big Bag Bed, and other fabric growing containers made in the USA. Remember, the container you use affects the plants you grow. SmartPots.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, I say potassium, you probably say potash. It is the common term for the K in NPK, the big three of fertilizers out there. But what means muriate of potash, and why does the state of California think it causes cancer? We will address all those issues after a couple more of your fabulous phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Deborah, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello, Mike. How are you?
I am doing just fine. Deb, how are you?
Very good. Longtime follower of the show.
Oh, thank you so much, Ed. We've been around a while. Where are you?
I am in Wagontown, Chester County. beautiful little village about an hour west of Philadelphia.
Was it named after a happy dog?
No, it was actually named after the Wagon Inn, very old inn where, who knows, George Washington might have actually made an appearance.
There you
it's
go.
It's a lot of historic structures here.
All right. What can we do for Deb in the Living History Museum of Pennsylvania?
Well, I was given an amaryllis a few years ago, and I've had great success with it. And last year, it multiplied into two bulbs, and each bulb sent up a flower stem, and I had, gosh, maybe 15, 20 blooms between the two of them. It was just spectacular.
Congratulations.
And, yes, I was, and it's a beautiful striped, red and cream striped variety. So
I know that one. I know that one. I have a couple of those.
So I took it down to the basement. I had it outside all this past summer, this year. And it got a lot of nice fronds on it, and then I took it down to the basement, and the fronds died. And okay. In the course of repotting it, the bulbs had really multiplied. I had two large ones, two medium ones, and one or two little tiny bulblets.
Mm-hmm.
So I tried to split them up, and I could not do it. And I just hesitated. I pulled, I pried, I used a fork, I tried to use a knife, and I really hesitated to take a cleaver and just, it just would have hurt my heart. You know what I mean? So I just repotted them, put them up in a sunny window here, and they're all getting fronds, but no bud stems. So I'm just wondering if I did the wrong thing or the right thing.
It may simply have needed a rest. You may not have done anything wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But I'll go over the basics. The basic rules are after the flowers fade, you clip off the seed head to stop that kind of production because these
okay.
things will reproduce by seed and by those little bulbets they form at the bottom. And then typically what happens is the leaves come out. At that point, it is important to feed the bulb.
Oh,
so
when I'm putting it outside for the summer and all the fronds are coming out, you mean?
Exactly. When those leaves...
I guess I do feed it. I can't
When
remember.
Those leaves are starting to get a good size, the bulb needs food, both in the form of sunlight and both in the form of food. So that's a great time to start feeding it a gentle, like compost tea or a soluble organic fertilizer like Half Strength. Then when it goes outside for the summer, then you can really hit it with a nice thing of fish emulsion and seaweed because you don't care what it smells like. But the one that you only got the leaves on this year, I wouldn't sweat it. I would just follow the drill as if it had flowered and these leaves were following it. So you want to make sure these leaves get a lot of sun, a lot of food, and then maybe, especially because the leaves are out already very early, maybe this is one that you snatch back out of the summertime garden in July and put it in a cool, dark place and make sure it gets a solid 3 months of dormancy. No light other than the weakest ambient light, no food, no water. And then make sure it goes completely dormant. My understanding is 3 months is the minimum, but 4 months is fine. And then typically, if you've gotten it correct, a lot of times, even when you go back to then repot them and reactivate them to get them growing again, you'll see the sign of that very distinctive thing in the center that shows you you've got a flower stalk coming up already.
Now, what about the fact that there's so many bulbs together? Should I, that's not a problem? I don't have to separate them?
A lot of people would take off the little bulblets. You know, they're kind of like it's going to take a lot of years for them to get up to full size. You can treat those the same way, but I would put them in a little nursery thing instead.
Okay.
And I would just be brave. I'd snap one off. Just take it in your hands. Think of somebody, you know, back in the old prom days or something, and just snap that sucker right off.
Okay.
And be fearless. And I don't think you're going to hurt those two main bulbs, and those are the ones that I would really go after.
Well, I'm really enjoying them. I had another friend who grew them for years and years, and I always admired it, so I'm enjoying them now.
The fun factor for amaryllis is almost unlimited.
Yes.
Good luck with your double amaryllis. I predict great success next season.
Thank you very much, Mike.
Take care.
Okay, bye-bye.
1-888-346-9499. Tom, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. It's a pleasure to speak with you.
Hey, Tom. How you doing?
I'm doing great.
And where is Tom doing great?
In Cedar Hill, Tennessee.
Okay, so you know I have no idea where Cedar Hill, Tennessee is.
Well, it's a small community, about 328 people, about 20 miles north of Nashville.
Okay, so what can we do for Tom in Cedar Hill, just outside of Nashville?
Well, I enjoy listening to you each week, and I've heard you speak often about the raised bed gardens, and I'm interested in trying that, but in a slightly different way. My wife, Michelle, she's a fabulous cook, and she loves using the freshest vegetables and everything she cooks. Plus, we eat a ton of salad.
Right.
So most of the time, we buy this locally, or we get it from a few plants that Michelle keeps on the kitchen counter. But we have this hot tub that's sitting on the deck that we don't use. And instead of getting rid of it, I was thinking of turning this into a little raised bed garden. It's seamless. It's made of fiberglass. It's about 6 feet in diameter, and it's about 2 feet deep. It's in a great location. It faces the west and the south, and gets sun practically all day long. I don't think I want to completely fill the tub with soil because it might get too heavy for the deck. I was thinking about putting like styrofoam peanuts in the bottom, but I thought that the water might just drain to the bottom and then get stagnant. So I was wondering what you thought about this idea, about using this, first of all, and if I was to use it, how do I make this work with soil and drainage?
Okay, so this is Cowboy Gardening 101, and it's not going to be raised bed gardening. You're going to create a giant container.
Okay.
Is there anything in the bottom of the tub that can be opened up? Is there a drain in the very bottom?
No.
To make this work well, you're going to have to either cut a panel out of the bottom and install kind of a sewer grating for the water to drain out, or you're going to take a power drill and drill 100 little holes.
Okay. Well, and, that's a good idea, yeah.
And be aware that the water is going to drain out the bottom of this, but it's sitting on top of a deck, so there's going to be airflow underneath. Okay, so yeah. 2 feet deep and 6 feet around. Can you reach the center by walking around?
Yes.
Now, this is going to be a giant container, and what we fill it with is going to be helpful in terms of the weight. Styrofoam peanuts, I don't like the idea of peanuts in the bottom of it. I think that they would also migrate up.
Okay.
So what I would do is I would find the most lightweight stone I could, and I would put 6 inches in the bottom, and then you're going to make a big investment. You are going to go out, and you're going to find a nursery or a garden center that will sell you bulk professional mix. It's a combination of milled peat moss with enough lime to equal out the acidity, and then a perlite and vermiculite and a little bit of forest products or compost or something like that. And it comes in giant bales that when you wet them, that it increases the size dramatically.
Okay.
If you want to do this right, 6 inches of lightweight stone on the bottom, and on top of that, a 50-50 mix of this professional mix and the best high-quality compost you can find. If the compost makes the mix seem a little heavy when you're starting out, get a couple of big bags of perlite alone. Perlite is a mined volcanic glass sold in huge bags as big as you and I, that weigh about 5 pounds. It brings air into the soil. It helps that moisture get through. It'll keep your mix lightweight. And then every year you can add some compost to the top to feed your plants, or you can feed them with a fish and seaweed mix. The only thing I'll add is line it up so that you can run some row covers down the center for your salad greens. You can grow salad greens all winter long. So you'll grow your summertime plants on the outskirts, run salad greens down the center. You should go to town. They'll need to be protected from the summer heat. You may not be able to grow your salad greens in the summer.
Okay.
But you'll grow them all winter long.
Thank you so much, Mike. You have a blessed day. I really appreciate all your help.
All right. Good luck, sir. Great adventure.
Thank you very much.
All right. As promised, it's time for the question of the week. potash. And it's one way to get the K in your NPK. Alexis Landis, producer of You Bet Your Garden, please get us started with this week's fine question.
I'd be happy to, Mike. We heard from Jack, quote, originally from St. Louis, but currently residing in Richboro, PA. He writes, is muriate of potash safe to use as an additive in the raised bed gardens I'll be planting next spring? And if so, do you recommend it? I used it very sparingly along with bone meal and blood meal in an in-ground garden I had in St. Louis, where the clay content of the soil was very high. The garden seemed to have no problems producing tomatoes, cucumbers, summer squash, and cantaloupe, although the cantaloupe was not very flavorful. I plan on filling my raised beds with a mixture of premium topsoil and my own compost, which started out as a mix of fall leaves and food waste in a tumbler. The beds will be planted with the same kinds of vegetables as in St. Louis. I've purchased the blood meal and bone meal, but none of the garden hardware superstores around me carry muriate of potash. An internet search yielded plenty of results, but some sites had warnings that potash is known by the state of California to cause cancer, which is what led me to seek your advice. Okay, Dr. Science, got a lot of splaining to do here, so take it away.
Well, potash is an archaic term that today is used to describe any form of potassium that's used as a fertilizer. But centuries ago, the material would have been made by boiling wood and other plant ashes in a pot, which would concentrate the naturally occurring potassium in the ashes. Hence, pot ash, potassium in the form of ashes in a pot.
Potassium is the K in the big three of NPK, the initials used to indicate the primary plant nutrients nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium.
Right. Nitrogen grows big plants, but it can inhibit flowering and fruiting if you use too much. Phosphorus produces stronger roots and is also known as the flowering nutrient. It encourages plants to produce lots more flowers and fruits. Potassium pretty much does just about everything else. It increases water retention, vigor, yields, nutrient content, color, and flavor.
So the words potassium and potash are equivalent?
That's almost a religious discussion. Virtually all of the potassium fertilizers sold today are mined from what used to be prehistoric oceans that are all now inland, while a true potash would be made from ashes. Muriate of potash is technically a contradiction in terms because it refers to a specific form of potassium, potassium chloride, that's mined along with salt from those old oceanic deposits, and it never saw a pot or ashes. The word muriate even refers to brine or salt, but old-timers love the word, so potash is always going to be in the NPK lexicon.
Have we been of any actual help to our listeners so far?
Well, not that I can tell, so let's cut to the chase. Jack is using blood meal to add nitrogen to his garden and bone meal for phosphorus. Now, both are slaughterhouse byproducts that some people might oppose ethically, but they're about as natural as it gets. Muriate of potash, aka potassium chloride, is just the opposite. It's a man-made chemical that's generally available in what I consider to be crazy high concentrations. So if he really wants to add the big three individually, I'm going to recommend he stick to the natural path and look for green sand instead.
Green sand, that's the stuff that's only found in New Jersey, right?
Well, New Jersey is the site of the biggest known deposit, a place that was an ocean shore 80 million or so years ago. The material looks like its name. It's a green-colored sand. Although the bag will say that it only contains 1% potassium, it actually contains 7%, as this form of potassium is released slowly over time. Green sand also contains a lot of important and hard-to-find trace minerals, and it's said to improve the structure of both clay and sandy soils. But I would be remiss if I did not add that compost and composted manures naturally contain a good amount of potassium, in a form that should be much more immediately available to the plants.
Right. Well, Mike, you just add 2 inches of fresh compost to your beds every season to satisfy your plants' nutritional needs. Now, what about this California cancer warning?
Well, back in 1986, California voters adopted what's known as Proposition 65 by a wide margin. The act requires that anything that could potentially cause cancer or birth defects carry the scary warning that you see on a lot of everyday objects. The list is updated every year, and a quick scan of the 800 currently listed chemicals includes really bad actors like arsenic, creosote, the nasty seed treatment Captan, and virtually every chemical herbicide I've ever heard of.
But I've also seen that warning on clothing and plumbing fixtures.
Well, the threshold to getting on the list is very low, and many people do feel that the warnings lack potency because they do seem so ubiquitous. But then again, maybe we blithely use a lot of things that might explain why we don't seem to be winning that war on cancer. Well, that sure was some interesting information about potash now, wasn't it? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over in detail, click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week. Yikes, my producer is threatening to ash my pots if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499. Or send us your email, you're tired, you're poor, you're wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please include your location, especially if you are certain that we do not need it. And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you'll find the answers to all your garden questions, audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Terry Murray is vice president of production. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Our ashen engineer is Al Banks. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Webmasters Larissa Sapko and Rich Banowitz keep our website potassium rich. Overflowing with nitrogen is Alexis Landis, who occasionally produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. Our associate producer of Production Association is Brett Rader. Our phosphorescent editor is Al Banks. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and I'm traveling back in time to make sure the dinosaurs are fairly compensated for the loss of their green sand. So until the Doctor, the Legion, Rip Hunter, or Booster Gold stop by to bring me back to the new age of Thunder Lizards, I'll just say that I hope to see you again next week, or maybe it'll be last week, or centuries ago, or maybe Jurassic Park. I bet you there's some fine nutrients in that dino dung now that I think about it. Seed starting is not for the timid, but if you have experience, bravado, or both, we'll talk about the best way to try and get those seeds started on the next You Bet Your Garden. Plus your fabulous phone calls.